Ashenden, W. Somerset Maugham, Chapter 10, The Traitor. Having taken a room at the hotel at which he'd been instructed to stay, Ashenden went out. It was a lovely day, early in August, and the sun shone in an unclouded sky. He'd not been to Lucerne since he was a boy, and but vaguely remembered a covered bridge, a great stone lion, and a church in which he'd sat, bored yet impressed, while they played an organ. And now wandering along a shady quay, and the lake looked just as tawdry and unreal as it looked on the picture postcards, he tried not so much to find his way about a half-forgotten scene as to reform in his mind some recollection of the shy and eager lad, so impatient for life, which he saw not in the present of his adolescence, but only in the future of his manhood, who so long ago had wandered there. But it seemed to him that the most vivid of his memories was not of himself, but of the crowd. He seemed to remember sun and heat and people. The train was crowded, and so was the hotel. The lake steamers were packed, and on the quays and in the streets, you threaded your way among the throng of holidaymakers. They were fat and old and ugly and odd, and they stank. Now, in wartime, Lucerne was as deserted as it must have been before the world at large discovered that Switzerland was the playground of Europe. Many of the hotels were closed, the streets were empty, the rowing boats for hire rocked idly at the water's edge, and there was none to take them. And in the avenues by the lake, the only persons to be seen were serious Swiss taking their neutrality, like a dachshund, for a walk with them. Ashenden felt exhilarated by the solitude, and sitting down on a bench that faced the water, surrendered himself deliberately to the sensation. It was true that the lake was absurd, the water was too blue, the mountains too snowy, and its beauty, hitting you in the face, exasperated rather than thrilled. But all the same, there was something pleasing in the prospect, an artless candor, like one of Mendelssohn's Songs Without Words, that made Ashenden smile with complacency. Lucerne reminded him of wax flowers under glass cases and cuckoo clocks and fancy work in Berlin wool. So long, at all events, as the fine weather lasted, he was prepared to enjoy himself. He didn't see why he should not at least try to combine pleasure to himself with profit to his country. He was traveling with a brand new passport in his pocket, under a borrowed name, and this gave him an agreeable sense of owning a new personality. He was often slightly tired of himself, and it diverted him for a while to be merely a creature of R's facile invention. The experience he had just enjoyed appealed to his acute sense of the absurd. R, it is true, had not seen the fun of it. What humor R possessed was of sardonic turn, and he had no facility for taking in good part a joke at his own expense. To do that, you must be able to look at yourself from the outside and be at the same time spectator and actor in the pleasant comedy of life. R was a soldier and regarded introspection as unhealthy, un-English, and unpatriotic. Ashenden got up and strolled slowly to his hotel. It was a small German hotel of the second class, spotlessly clean, and his bedroom had a nice view. It was furnished with brightly varnished pitch pine, and though on a cold, wet day it would have been wretched, in that warm and sunny weather it was gay and pleasing. There were tables in the hall, and he sat down at one of these and ordered a bottle of beer. The landlady was curious to know why in that dead season he'd come to stay, and he was glad to satisfy her curiosity. He told her that he had recently recovered from an attack of typhoid and had come to Lucerne to get back his strength. He was employed in the censorship department and was taking the opportunity to brush up his rusty German. He asked her if she could recommend to him a German teacher. The landlady was a blonde and blowsy Swiss, with good humor and talkative, so that Ashenden felt pretty sure that she would repeat in the proper quarter the information he gave her. It was his turn now to ask a few questions. She was voluble on the subject of the war, on account of which the hotel, in that month so full that rooms had to be found for visitors in neighboring houses, was nearly empty. A few people came in from outside to eat their meals en pension, but she had only two lots of resident guests. One was an old Irish couple who lived in Vevey and passed their summers in Lucerne, and the other was an Englishman and his wife. She was a German, and they were obliged on that account to live in a neutral country. Ashenden took care to show a little curiosity about them. He recognized in the description Grantley Caper, but of her own accord she told him that they spent most of the day walking about the mountains. Herr Caper was a botanist and much interested in the flora of the country. His lady was a very nice woman, and she felt her position keenly. Ah, well, the war could not last forever. The landlady bustled away, and Ashenden went upstairs. Dinner was at 7, and wishing to be in the dining room before anyone else so that he could take stock of his fellow guests as they entered, he went down as soon as he heard the bell. It was a very plain, stiff, whitewashed room, with chairs of the same shiny pitch pine as in his bedroom, and on the walls were oleographs of Swiss lakes. On each little table was a bunch of flowers. It was all neat and clean, and presaged a bad dinner. Ashenden would have liked to make up for it by ordering a bottle of the best Rhine wine to be found in the hotel, but did not venture to draw attention to himself by extravagance. He saw on two or three tables half-empty bottles of table hock, which made him surmise that his fellow guests drank thriftily, and so contented himself with ordering a pint of lager. Presently, one or two persons came in, single men with some occupation in Lucerne, and obviously Swiss, and sat down each at his own little table and untied the napkins that at the end of the luncheon they had neatly tied up. They propped newspapers against their water jugs and read while they somewhat noisily ate their soup. Then entered a very old, tall, bent man with white hair and a drooping white mustache, accompanied by a little old white-haired lady in black. They were certainly the Irish colonel and his wife, of whom the landlady had spoken. They took their seats, and the colonel poured out a thimbleful of wine for his wife and a thimbleful for himself. They waited in silence for their dinner to be served to them by the buxom, hearty maid. At last the persons arrived for whom Ashenden had been waiting. He was doing his best to read a German book, and it was only by an exercise of self-control that he allowed himself, only for one moment, to raise his eyes as they came in. His glance showed him a man of about 45 with short dark hair, somewhat grizzled, of middle height, but corpulent, with a broad, red, clean-shaven face. He wore a shirt open at the neck, with a wide collar and a gray suit. He walked ahead of his wife, and of her Ashenden only caught the impression of a German woman, self-effaced and dusty. Grantley Caper sat down and began in a loud voice explaining to the waitress that they had taken an immense walk. They had been up some mountain, the name of which meant nothing to Ashenden, but which excited in the maid expressions of astonishment and enthusiasm. Then Caper, still in fluent German but with a marked English accent, said that they were so late they had not even gone up to wash, but had just rinsed their hands outside. He had a resonant voice and a jovial manner. "Serve me quick. We're starving with hunger, and bring beer. Bring three bottles. Lieber Gott, what a thirst I have." He seemed to be a man of exuberant vitality. He brought into that dull, overclean dining room the breath of life, and everyone in it appeared on a sudden more alert. He began to talk to his wife, in English, and everything he said could be heard by all. But presently she interrupted him with a remark made in an undertone. Caper stopped, and Ashenden felt that his eyes were turned in his direction. Mrs. Caper had noticed the arrival of a stranger, and had drawn her husband's attention to it. Ashenden turned the page of the book he was pretending to read, but he felt that Caper's gaze was fixed intently upon him. When he addressed his wife again, it was in so low a tone that Ashenden could not even tell what language he used, but when the maid brought them their soup, Caper, his voice still low, asked her a question. It was plain that he was inquiring who Ashenden was. Ashenden could catch of the maid's reply but the one word, Lende. One or two people finished their dinner and went out picking their teeth. The old Irish colonel and his old wife rose from their table, and he stood aside to let her pass. They had eaten their meal without exchanging a word. She walked slowly to the door, but the colonel stopped to say a word to a Swiss who might have been a local attorney, and when she reached it, she stood there, bowed, and with a sheep-like look, patiently waited for her husband to come and open it for her. Ashenden realized that she had never opened a door for herself. She did not know how to. In a minute, the colonel, with his old gait, came to the door and opened it. She passed out, and he followed. The little incident offered a key to their whole lives, and from it, Ashenden began to reconstruct their histories, circumstances, and characters. But he pulled himself up. He could not allow himself the luxury of creation. He finished his dinner. When he went into the hall, he saw tied to the leg of a table a bull terrier, and in passing, mechanically put his hand down to fondle the dog's drooping, soft ears. The landlady was standing at the foot of the stairs. "Whose is this lovely beast?" asked Ashenden. "He belongs to Herr Kapor. Fritzy, he's called. Herr Kapor says he has a longer pedigree than the King of England." Fritzy rubbed himself against Ashenden's leg, and with his nose sought the palm of his hand. Ashenden went upstairs to fetch his hat, and when he came down, saw Kapor standing at the entrance of the hotel talking with the landlady. From the sudden silence and their constrained manner, he guessed that Kapor had been making inquiries about him. When he passed between them, into the street, out of the corner of his eye, he saw Kapor give him a suspicious stare. That frank, jovial red face bore then a look of shifty cunning. Ashenden strolled along till he found a tavern where he could have his coffee in the open, and to compensate himself for the bottle of beer that his sense of duty had urged him to drink at dinner, ordered the best brandy the house provided. He was pleased at last to have come face to face with the man of whom he'd heard so much, and in a day or two hoped to become acquainted with him. It is never very difficult to get to know anyone who has a dog, but he was in no hurry. He would let things take their course. With the object he had in view, he could not afford to be hasty. Ashenden reviewed the circumstances. Grantley Kapor was an Englishman, born according to his passport in Birmingham, and he was 42 years old. His wife, to whom he'd been married for 11 years, was of German birth and parentage. That was public knowledge. Information about his antecedents was contained in a private document. He had started life, according to this, in a lawyer's office in Birmingham, and then had drifted into journalism. He'd been connected with an English paper in Cairo and with another in Shanghai. There, he had got into trouble for attempting to get money on false pretenses and was sentenced to a short term of imprisonment. All trace of him was lost for 2 years after his release, when he reappeared in a shipping office in Marseille. From there, still in the shipping business, he went to Hamburg, where he married, and to London. In London, he set himself up in the export business, but after some time failed and was made a bankrupt. He returned to journalism. At the outbreak of war, he was once more in the shipping business, and in August 1914 was living quietly with his German wife at Southampton. In the beginning of the following year, he told his employers that owing to the nationality of his wife, his position was intolerable. They had no fault to find with him, and recognizing that he was in an awkward fix, granted his request that he should be transferred to Genoa. Here he remained till Italy entered the war, but then gave notice, and with his papers in perfect order, crossed the border and took up his residence in Switzerland. All this indicated a man of doubtful honesty and unsettled disposition, with no background and no financial standing. But the facts were of no importance to anyone till it was discovered that Kapor, certainly from the beginning of the war and perhaps sooner, was in the service of the German intelligence department. He had a salary of £40 a month, but though dangerous and wily, no steps would have been taken to deal with him if he had contented himself with transmitting such news as he was able to get in Switzerland. He could do no great harm there, and it might even be possible to make use of him to convey information that it was desirable to let the enemy have. He had no notion that anything was known of him. His letters, and he received a good many, were closely censored. There were few codes that the people who dealt with such matters could not, in the end, decipher, and it might be that sooner or later, through him, it would be possible to lay hands on the organization that still flourished in England. But then he did something that drew R's attention to him. Had he known it, none could have blamed him for shaking in his shoes. R was not a very nice man to get on the wrong side of. Capor scraped acquaintance in Zurich with a young Spaniard, Gomez by name, who had lately entered the British Secret Service. By his nationality, inspired him with confidence, and managed to worm out of him the fact that he was engaged in espionage. Probably the Spaniard, with a very human desire to seem important, had done no more than talk mysteriously. But on Capor's information, he was watched when he went to Germany, and one day caught just as he was posting a letter in a code that was eventually deciphered. He was tried, convicted, and shot. It was bad enough to lose a useful and disinterested agent, but it entailed besides the changing of a safe and simple code. R was not pleased, but R was not the man to let any desire of revenge stand in the way of his main object, and it occurred to him that if Capor was merely betraying his country for money, it might be possible to get him to take more money to betray his employers. The fact that he had succeeded in delivering into their hands an agent of the Allies must seem to them an earnest of his good faith. He might be very useful. But R had no notion what kind of man Capor was. He had lived his shabby, furtive life obscurely, and the only photograph that existed of him was one taken for a passport. Ashenden's instructions were to get acquainted with Capor and see whether there was any chance that he would work honestly for the British. If he thought there was, he was entitled to sound him, and if his suggestions were met with favor, to make certain propositions. It was a task that needed tact and a knowledge of men. If, on the other hand, Ashenden came to the conclusion that Capor could not be bought, he was to watch and report his movements. The information he had obtained from Gustav was vague, but important. There was only one point in it that was interesting, and that was that the head of the German intelligence department in Bern was growing restive at Capor's lack of activity. Capor was asking for a higher salary, and Major von P. had told him that he must earn it. It might be that he was urging him to go to England. If he could be induced to cross the frontier, Ashenden's work was done. "How the devil do you expect me to persuade him to put his head in a noose?" asked Ashenden. "It won't be a noose. It'll be his firing squad," said R. "Capor's clever." "Well, be cleverer, damn your eyes." Ashenden made up his mind that he would take no steps to make Capor's acquaintance, but allow the first advances to be made by him. If he was being pressed for results, it must surely occur to him that it would be worthwhile to get into conversation with an Englishman who was employed in the censorship department. Ashenden was prepared with a supply of information that it could not in the least benefit the Central Powers to possess. With a false name and a false passport, he had little to fear that Capor would guess that he was a British agent. Ashenden did not have to wait long. Next day, he was sitting in the doorway of the hotel, drinking a cup of coffee, and already half asleep after a substantial Mittagessen, when the Capors came out of the dining room. Mrs. Capor went upstairs, and Capor released his dog. The dog bounded along and in a friendly fashion leaped up against Ashenden. "Come here, Fritzy," cried Capor, and then to Ashenden, "I'm so sorry, but he's quite gentle." "Oh, that's all right. He won't hurt me." Capor stopped at the doorway. "He's a bull terrier. You don't often see them on the continent." He seemed, while he spoke, to be taking Ashenden's measure. He called to the maid. "A coffee, please, Fraulein. You've just arrived, haven't you?" "Yes, I came yesterday." "Really? I didn't see you in the dining room last night. Are you making a stay?" "I don't know. I've been ill and I've come here to recuperate." The maid came with the coffee, and seeing Capor talking to Ashenden, put the tray on the table at which he was sitting. Capor gave a laugh of faint embarrassment. "I don't want to force myself upon you. I don't know why the maid put my coffee on your table." "Please, sit down," said Ashenden. "It's very good of you. I've lived so long on the continent that I'm always forgetting that my countrymen are apt to look upon it as confounded cheek if you talk to them. Are you English, by the way, or American?
English, said Ashenden.
Ashenden was by nature a very shy person, and he had in vain tried to cure himself of a failing that at his age was unseemly, but on occasion he knew how to make effective use of it. He explained now in a hesitating and awkward manner the facts that he had the day before told the landlady, and that he was convinced she had already passed on to Caper.
You couldn't have come to a better place than Lucerne. It's an oasis of peace in this war-weary world. When you're here, you might almost forget that there's such a thing as a war going on. That's why I've come here. I'm a journalist by profession.
I couldn't help wondering if you wrote, said Ashenden, with an eagerly timid smile. It was clear that he had not learnt that oasis of peace in a war-weary world at the shipping office.
You see, I married a German lady, said Kapor gravely.
Oh, really? I don't think anyone could be more patriotic than I am. I'm English through and through, and I don't mind telling you that, in my opinion, the British Empire is the greatest instrument for good that the world has ever seen. But having a German wife, I naturally see a good deal of the reverse of the medal. You don't have to tell me that the Germans have faults, but frankly, I'm not prepared to admit that they're devils incarnate. At the beginning of the war, my poor wife had a very rough time in England, and I, for one, couldn't have blamed her if she'd felt rather bitter about it. Everyone thought she was a spy. It'll make you laugh when you know her. She's the typical German Hausfrau, who cares nothing but for her house and her husband and our only child, Fritzi.
Caper fondled his dog and gave a little laugh.
Yes, Fritzi, you are a child, aren't you? Naturally, it made my position very awkward. I was connected with some very important papers, and my editors weren't quite comfortable about it. Well, to cut a long story short, I thought the most dignified course was to resign and come to a neutral country till the storm blew over. My wife and I never discussed the war, though I'm bound to tell you that it's more on my account than hers. She's much more tolerant than I am, and she's more willing to look upon this terrible business from my point of view than I am from hers.
That is strange, said Ashenden. As a rule, women are so much more rabid than men. My wife is a very remarkable person. I should like to introduce you to her. By the way, I don't know if you know my name, Grantley Caper.
My name is Somerville, said Ashenden. He told him then of the work he'd been doing in the censorship department, and he fancied that into Caper's eyes came a certain intentness. Presently, he told him that he was looking for someone to give him conversation lessons in German so that he might rub up his rusty knowledge of the language. And as he spoke, a notion flashed across his mind. He gave Caper a look and saw that the same notion had come to him. It had occurred to them at the same instant that it would be a very good plan for Ashenden's teacher to be Mrs. Caper. I asked our landlady if she could find me someone, and she said she thought she could. I must ask her again. It ought not to be very hard to find a man who's prepared to come and talk German to me for an hour a day.
I wouldn't take anyone on the landlady's recommendation, said Caper. After all, you want somebody with a good North German accent, and she only talks Swiss. I'll ask my wife if she knows anyone. My wife's a very highly educated woman, and you could trust her recommendation.
That's very kind of you. Ashenden observed Grantley Caper at his ease. He noticed how the small gray-green eyes, which last night he had not been able to see, contradicted the red, good-humored frankness of his face. They were quick and shifty, but when the mind behind them was seized by an unexpected notion, they were suddenly still. It gave one a peculiar feeling of the working of the brain. They were not eyes that inspired confidence. Caper did that with his jolly, good-natured smile, the openness of his broad, weather-beaten face, his comfortable obesity, and the cheeriness of his loud, deep voice. He was doing his best now to be agreeable. While Ashenden talked to him, a little shyly still, but gaining confidence from that breezy, cordial manner capable of putting anyone at his ease, it intrigued him to remember that the man was a common spy. It gave a tang to his conversation to reflect that he'd been ready to sell his country for no more than £40 a month.
Ashenden had known Gomez, the young Spaniard whom Capor had betrayed. He was a high-spirited youth with a love of adventure, and he had undertaken his dangerous mission not for the money he earned by it, but from a passion for romance. It amused him to outwit the clumsy German, and it appealed to his sense of the absurd to play a part in a shilling shocker. It was not very nice to think of him now 6 feet underground in a prison yard. He was young, and he had a certain grace of gesture. Ashenden wondered whether Caper had felt a qualm when he delivered him to the destruction. "I suppose you know a little German?" asked Capor, interested in the stranger. "Oh, yes, I was a student in Germany, and I used to talk it fluently, but that's long ago and I've forgotten. I can still read it very comfortably." "Oh, yes, I noticed you were reading a German book last night." Fool! It was only a little while since he had told Ashenden that he had not seen him at dinner. He wondered whether Caper had observed the slip. How difficult it was never to make one. Ashenden must be on his guard. The thing that made him most nervous was the thought that he might not answer readily enough to his assumed name of Somerville. Of course, there was always the chance that Capor had made the slip on purpose to see by Ashenden's face whether he noticed anything. Capor got up. "There's my wife. We go for a walk up one of the mountains every afternoon. I can tell you some charming walks. The flowers, even now, are lovely." "I'm afraid I must wait till I'm a bit stronger," said Ashenden, with a little sigh. He had naturally a pale face and never looked as robust as he was. Mrs. Capor came downstairs and her husband joined her. They walked down the road, Fritzy bounding round them, and Ashenden saw that Capor immediately began to speak with volubility. He was evidently telling his wife the results of his interview with Ashenden. Ashenden looked at the sun shining so gaily on the lake. The shadow of a breeze fluttered the green leaves of the trees. Everything invited to a stroll. He got up, went to his room, and throwing himself on his bed, had a very pleasant sleep. He went into dinner that evening as the capers were finishing, for he had wandered melancholy about Lucerne in the hope of finding a cocktail that would enable him to face the potato salad that he foresaw, and on their way out of the dining room, Capor stopped and asked him if he would drink coffee with them. When Ashenden joined them in the hall, Capor got up and introduced him to his wife. She bowed stiffly, and no answering smile came to her face to respond to Ashenden's civil greeting. It was not hard to see that her attitude was definitely hostile. It put Ashenden at his ease. She was a plainish woman, nearing 40, with a muddy skin and vague features. Her drab hair was arranged in a plait around her head like that of Napoleon's Queen of Prussia, and she was squarely built, plump rather than fat, and solid. But she did not look stupid. She looked, on the contrary, a woman of character, and Ashenden, who had lived enough in Germany to recognize the type, was ready to believe that, though capable of doing the housework, cooking the dinner and climbing a mountain, she might be also prodigiously well-informed. She wore a white blouse that showed a sunburned neck, a black skirt, and heavy walking boots. Capor, addressing her in English, told her in his jovial way, as though she did not know it already, what Ashenden had told him about himself. She listened grimly. "I think you told me you understood German," said Capor, his big red face wreathed in polite smiles, but his little eyes darting about restlessly. "Yes, I was for some time a student in Heidelberg." "Really?" said Mrs. Capor in English, an expression of faint interest for a moment, chasing away the sullenness from her face. "I know Heidelberg very well. I was at school there for 1 year." Her English was correct, but throaty, and the mouthing emphasis she gave her words was disagreeable. Ashenden was diffuse in praise of the old university town and the beauty of the neighborhood. She heard him, from the standpoint of her Teutonic superiority, with toleration rather than with enthusiasm. "It's well known that the Valley of the Neckar is one of the beauty places of the whole world," she said. "I've not told you, my dear," said Capor then, "that Mr. Somerville is looking for someone to give him conversation lessons while he's here. I told him that perhaps you could suggest a teacher." "No, I know no one whom I could conscientiously recommend," she answered. "The Swiss accent is hateful beyond words. It could do Mr. Somerville only harm to converse with a Swiss. If I were in your place, Mr. Somerville, I would try and persuade my wife to give you lessons. She is, if I may say so, a very cultivated and highly educated woman. Ah, Grantly, I have not the time. I have my own work to do. Ashton saw that he was being given his opportunity. The trap was prepared, and all he had to do was to fall in. He turned to Mrs. Capor with a manner that he tried to make shy, deprecating, and modest. Of course, it would be too wonderful if you would give me lessons. I should look upon it as a real privilege. Naturally, I wouldn't want to interfere with your work. I am just here to get well, with nothing in the world to do, and I would suit my time entirely to your convenience. He felt a flash of satisfaction pass from one to the other, and in Mrs. Caper's blue eyes he fancied that he saw a dark glow. Of course, it would be a purely business arrangement, said Caper. There's no reason that my good wife shouldn't earn a little pin money. Would you think 10 francs an hour too much? No, said Ashton. I should think myself lucky to get a first-rate teacher for that. What do you say, my dear? Surely you can spare an hour, and you would be doing this gentleman a kindness. He would learn that all Germans are not devilish fiends that they think them in England. On Mrs. Caper's brow was an uneasy frown, and Ashton could not but think with apprehension of that hour's conversation a day that he was going to exchange with her. Heaven only knew how he would have to rack his brain for subjects of discourse with that heavy and morose woman. Now she made a visible effort. I shall be very pleased to give Mr. Somerville conversation lessons. I congratulate you, Mr. Somerville, said Capor noisily. You're in for a treat. When will you start? Tomorrow at 11? That would suit me very well if it suits Mrs. Capor. Yes, that's as good an hour as another, she answered. Ashton left them to discuss the happy outcome of their diplomacy. But when, punctually at 11 next morning, he heard a knock at his door, for it had been arranged that Mrs. Caper should give him his lesson in his room, it was not without trepidation that he opened it. It behooved him to be frank, a trifle indiscreet, but obviously wary of a German woman, sufficiently intelligent and impulsive. Mrs. Caper's face was dark and sulky. She plainly hated having anything to do with him. But they sat down, and she began, somewhat peremptorily, to ask him questions about his knowledge of German literature. She corrected his mistakes with exactness, and when he put before her some difficulty in German construction, explained it with clearness and precision. It was obvious that, though she hated giving him a lesson, she meant to give it conscientiously. She seemed to have not only an aptitude for teaching, but a love of it. And as the hour went on, she began to speak with greater earnestness. It was already only by an effort that she remembered that he was a brutal Englishman. Ashton, noticing the unconscious struggle within her, found himself not a little entertained. And it was with truth that when later in the day Capor asked him how the lesson had gone, he answered that it was highly satisfactory. Mrs. Capor was an excellent teacher and a most interesting person. I told you so. She's the most remarkable woman I know. And Ashton had a feeling that when in his hearty, laughing way Capor said this, he was for the first time entirely sincere. In a day or two, Ashton guessed that Mrs. Capor was giving him lessons only in order to enable Capor to arrive at a closer intimacy with him, for she confined herself strictly to matters of literature, music, and painting. And when Ashton, by way of experiment, brought the conversation round to the war, she cut him short. I think that is a topic that we had better avoid, Herr Somerville, she said. She continued to give her lessons with the greatest thoroughness, and he had his money's worth, but every day she came with the same sullen face, and it was only in the interest of teaching that she lost for a moment her instinctive dislike of him. Ashton exercised in turn, but in vain, all his wiles. He was ingratiating, ingenious, humble, grateful, flattering, simple, and timid. She remained coldly hostile. She was a fanatic. Her patriotism was aggressive but disinterested, and obsessed with the notion of the superiority of all things German. She loathed England with a virulent hatred because in that country she saw the chief obstacle of their diffusion. Her ideal was a German world in which the rest of the nations under a hegemony greater than that of Rome should enjoy the benefits of German science and German art and German culture. There was in the conception a magnificent impudence that appealed to Ashenden's sense of humor. She was no fool. She had read much in several languages, and she could talk of the books she had read with good sense. She had a knowledge of modern painting and modern music that not a little impressed Ashenden. It was amusing once to hear her before luncheon play one of those silvery little pieces of Debussy. She played it disdainfully because it was French and so light, but with an angry appreciation of his grace and gaiety. When Ashenden congratulated her, she shrugged her shoulders. "The decadent music of a decadent nation," she said. Then, with powerful hands, she struck the first resounding chords of a sonata by Beethoven. But she stopped. "I cannot play. I am out of practice. And you English, what do you know of music? You have not produced a composer since Purcell." "What do you think of that statement?" Ashenden, smiling, asked Capor, who was standing near. "I confess its truth. The little I know of music my wife taught me. I wish you could hear her play when she's in practice." He put his fat hand with its square, stumpy fingers on her shoulder. "She can wring your heartstrings with pure beauty." "Dummer Kerl," she said in a soft voice. "Stupid fellow." And Ashenden saw her mouth for a moment quiver, but she quickly recovered. "You English, you cannot paint, you cannot model, you cannot write music." "Some of us can at times write pleasing verses," said Ashenden, with good humor, for it was not his business to be put out. And he didn't know why, two lines occurring to him, he said them. "Whither, O splendid ship, thy white sails crowding, leaning across the bosom of the urgent west." "Yes," said Mrs. Capor with a strange gesture, "you can write poetry. I wonder why." And to Ashenden's surprise, she went on, in her guttural English, to recite the next two lines of the poem he'd quoted. "Come, Grantly, Mittagessen is ready. Let us go into the dining room." They left Ashenden reflective. Ashenden admired goodness, but was not outraged by wickedness. People sometimes thought him heartless because he was more often interested in others than attached to them, and even in the few to whom he was attached, his eyes saw with equal clearness the merits and the defects. When he liked people, it was not because he was blind to their faults. He didn't mind their faults, but accepted them with a tolerant shrug of the shoulders, or because he ascribed to them excellencies that they did not possess. And since he judged his friends with candor, they never disappointed him, and so he seldom lost one. He asked for none more than he could give. He was able to pursue his study of the Capors without prejudice and without passion. Mrs. Capor seemed to him more of a piece, and therefore the easier of the two to understand. She obviously detested him. Though it was so necessary for her to be civil to him, her antipathy was strong enough to wring from her now and then an expression of rudeness. And had she been safely able to do so, she would have killed him without a qualm. But in the pressure of Capor's chubby hand on his wife's shoulder, and in the fugitive trembling of her lips, Ashenden had divined that this unprepossessing woman and that mean fat man were joined together by a deep and sincere love. It was touching. Ashenden dissembled the observations that he'd been making for the past few days and little things that he'd noticed, but to which he had attached no significance, returned to him. It seemed to him that Mrs. Capor loved her husband because she was of a stronger character than he, and because she felt his dependence on her. She loved him for his admiration of her. And you might guess that, till she met him, this dumpy, plain woman with her dullness, good sense, and want of humor could not have much enjoyed the admiration of men. She enjoyed his heartiness and his noisy jokes, and his high spirit stirred her sluggish blood. He was a great big bouncing boy, and he could never be anything else, and she felt like a mother towards him. She had made him what he was, and he was her man, and she was his woman. And she loved him, notwithstanding his weakness. For with her clear head, she must always have been conscious of that. She loved him. Ach, was! As Isolde loved Tristan. But then, there was the espionage. Even Ashenden, with all his tolerance for human frailty, could not but feel that to betray your country for money is not a very pretty proceeding. Of course she knew it. Indeed, it was probably through her that Kapor had first been approached. He would never have undertaken such work if she had not urged him to do it. She loved him, and she was an honest and upright woman. By what devious means had she persuaded herself to force her husband to adopt so base and dishonorable a calling? Ashenden lost himself in a labyrinth of conjecture as he tried to piece together the actions of her mind. Grantley Kapor was another story. There was little to admire in him, but at that moment Ashenden was not looking for an object of admiration. But there was much that was singular and much that was unexpected in that gross and vulgar fellow. Ashenden watched with entertainment the suave manner in which the spy tried to inveigle him in his toils. It was a couple of days after his first lesson that Kapor, after dinner, his wife having gone upstairs, threw himself heavily into a chair by Ashenden's side. His faithful Fritzy came up to him and put his long muzzle with its black nose on his knee. "He has no brain," said Kapor, "but a heart of gold. Look at those little pink eyes. Did you ever see anything so stupid? And what an ugly face, but what incredible charm." "Have you had him long?" said Ashenden. "I got him in 1914, just before the outbreak of the war. By the way, what do you think of the news today? Of course, my wife and I never discuss the war. You can't think what a relief to me it is to find a fellow countryman to whom I can open my heart." He handed Ashenden a cheap Swiss cigar, and Ashenden, making a rueful sacrifice to duty, accepted it. "Of course, they haven't got a chance, the Germans," said Kapor. "Not a dog's chance. I knew they were beaten the moment we came in." His manner was earnest, sincere, and confidential. Ashenden made a commonplace rejoinder. "It's the greatest grief of my life that, owing to my wife's nationality, I was unable to do any war work. I tried to enlist the day the war broke out, but they wouldn't have me on account of my age. But I don't mind telling you, if the war goes on much longer, wife or no wife, I'm going to do something. With my knowledge of languages, they ought to be of some service to the censorship department. That's where you were, wasn't it?" That was the mark at which he'd been aiming, and in answer now to his well-directed questions, Ashenden gave him the information that he had already prepared. Kapor drew his chair a little nearer and dropped his voice. "I'm sure you wouldn't tell me anything that anyone shouldn't know, but after all, these Swiss are absolutely pro-German, and we don't want to give anyone the chance of overhearing." Then he went on another tack. He told Ashenden a number of things that were of a certain secrecy. "I wouldn't tell this to anybody else, you know, but I have one or two friends who are in pretty influential positions, and they know they can trust me." Thus encouraged, Ashenden was a little more deliberately indiscreet, and when they parted, both had reason to be satisfied. Ashenden guessed that Kapor's typewriter would be kept busy next morning, and that extremely energetic major in Bern would shortly receive a most interesting report. One evening, going upstairs after dinner, Ashenden passed an open bathroom. He caught sight of the Kapors. "Come in," cried Kapor in his cordial way. "We're washing our Fritzy." The bull terrier was constantly getting himself very dirty, and it was Kapor's pride to see him clean and white. Ashenden went in. Mrs. Kapor, with her sleeves turned up and a large white apron, was standing at one end of the bath, while Kapor, in a pair of trousers and a singlet, his fat, freckled arms bare, was soaping the wretched hound. "We have to do it at night," he said, "because the Fitzgeralds use this bath and they'd have a fit if they knew we washed the dog in it. We wait till they go to bed. Come along, Fritzy. Show the gentleman how beautifully you behave when you have your face scrubbed." The poor brute, woe begone but faintly wagging his tail to show that however foul was this operation performed on him, he bore no malice to the god who did it, was standing in the middle of the bath in 6 inches of water. He was soaped all over, and Kapor, talking the while, shampooed him with his great fat hands. "Oh, what a beautiful dog he's going to be when he's as white as the driven snow. His master will be as proud as Punch to walk out with him, and all the little lady dogs will say, 'Good gracious, who's that beautiful aristocratic-looking bull terrier, walking as though he owned the whole of Switzerland?' Now stand still while you have your ears washed. You couldn't bear to go out into the street with dirty ears, could you? Like a nasty little Swiss schoolboy. Noblesse oblige. Now the black nose. Oh, and all the soap is going into his little pink eyes, and they'll smart. Mrs. Kapor listened to this nonsense with a good-humored, sluggish smile on her broad, plain face, and presently, gravely, took a towel. Now he's going to have a ducking. Upsy-daisy. Kapor seized the dog by the forelegs and ducked him once and ducked him twice. There was a struggle, a flurry, and a splashing. Kapor lifted him out of the bath. Now go to mother and she'll dry you. Mrs. Kapor sat down and, taking the dog between her strong legs, rubbed him till the sweat poured off her forehead. And Fritzy, a little shaken and breathless, but happy it was all over, stood with his sweet, stupid face, white and shining. Blood will tell, cried Kapor exultantly. He knows the names of no less than 64 of his ancestors, and they were all nobly born. Ashenden was faintly troubled. He shivered a little as he walked upstairs. Then, one Sunday, Kapor told him that he and his wife were going on an excursion and would eat their luncheon at some little mountain restaurant, and he suggested that Ashenden, each paying his share, should come with them. After 3 weeks at Lucerne, Ashenden thought that his strength would permit him to venture the exertion. They started early. Mrs. Kapor, businesslike in her walking boots and Tyrolese hat and alpenstock, and Kapor in stockings and plus fours, looking very British. The situation amused Ashenden, and he was prepared to enjoy his day, but he meant to keep his eyes open. It was not inconceivable that the Kapors had discovered what he was, and it would not do to go too near a precipice. Mrs. Kapor would not hesitate to give him a push, and Kapor, for all his jolliness, was an ugly customer. But on the face of it, there was nothing to mar Ashenden's pleasure in the golden morning. The air was fragrant. Kapor was full of conversation. He told funny stories. He was gay and jovial. The sweat rolled off his great red face, and he laughed at himself because he was so fat. To Ashenden's astonishment, he showed a peculiar knowledge of the flowers. Once he went out of the way to pick one he saw a little distance from the path and brought it back to his wife. He looked at it tenderly. "Isn't it lovely?" he cried, and his shifty, gray-green eyes for a moment were as candid as a child's. "It's like a poem by Walter Savage Lander." "Botany is my husband's favorite science," said Mrs. Kapor. "I laugh at him sometimes. He's devoted to flowers. Often, when we've hardly had enough money to pay the butcher, he spent everything in his pocket to bring me a bunch of roses." "Qui fleurit sa maison fleurit son cœur," said Grantly Kapor. Ashenden had once or twice seen Kapor, coming in from a walk, offer Mrs. Fitzgerald a nosegay of mountain flowers with an elephantine courtesy that was not entirely displeasing. And what he had just learned added a certain significance to the pretty little action. His passion for flowers was genuine, and when he gave them to the old Irish lady, he gave her something he valued. He showed a real kindness of heart. Ashenden had always thought botany a tedious science, but Kapor, talking exuberantly as they walked along, was able to impart to it life and interest. He must have given it a good deal of study. "I've never written a book," he said. "There are too many books already, and any desire to write I have is satisfied by the more immediately profitable and quite ephemeral composition of an article for a daily paper. But if I stay here much longer, I have half a mind to write a book about the wildflowers of Switzerland. Oh, I wish you'd been here a little earlier. They were marvelous. But one wants to be a poet for that, and I'm only a poor newspaper man." It was curious to observe how he was able to combine real emotion with false fact. When they reached the inn, with its view of the mountains and the lake, it was good to see the sensual pleasure with which he poured down his throat a bottle of ice-cold beer. You could not but feel sympathy for a man who took so much delight in simple things. They lunched deliciously off scrambled eggs and mountain trout. Even Mrs. Kapor was moved to an unwonted gentleness by her surroundings. The inn was in an agreeably rural spot, It looked like a picture of a Swiss chalet in a book of early 19th century travels, and she treated Ashenden with something less than her usual hostility. When they arrived, she had burst into loud German exclamations on the beauty of the scene, and now, softened perhaps, too, by food and drink, her eyes, dwelling on the grandeur before her, filled with tears. She stretched out her hand. "It is dreadful, and I am ashamed. Notwithstanding this horrible and unjust war, I can feel in my heart at the moment nothing but happiness and gratitude." Kapor took her hand and pressed it, and, an unusual thing with him, addressing her in German, called her little pet names. It was absurd but touching. Ashenden, leaving them to their emotions, strolled through the garden and sat down on a bench that had been prepared for the comfort of the tourist. The view was, of course, spectacular, but it captured you. It was like a piece of music that was obvious and meretricious, but for the moment shattered your self-control. And as Ashenden lingered idly in that spot, he pondered over the mystery of Grantley Caper's treachery. If he liked strange people, he'd found in him one who was strange beyond belief. It would be foolish to deny that he had amiable traits. His joviality was not assumed. He was without pretense a hearty fellow, and he had real good nature. He was always ready to do a kindness. Ashenden had often watched him with the old Irish colonel and his wife, who were the only other residents of the hotel. He would listen good-humoredly to the old man's tedious stories of the Egyptian War, and he was charming with her. Now that Ashenden had arrived at terms of some familiarity with Kapor, he found that he regarded him less with repulsion than with curiosity. He didn't think that he'd become a spy merely for the money. He was a man of modest tastes, and what he had earned in a shipping office must have sufficed to so good a manager as Mrs. Kapor. And after war was declared, there was no lack of remunerative work for men over the military age. It might be that he was one of those men who prefer devious ways to straight for some intricate pleasure they get in fooling their fellows, and that he had turned spy, not from hatred of the country that had imprisoned him, not even from love of his wife, but from a desire to score off bigwigs who never even knew of his existence. It might be that it was vanity that impelled him, a feeling that his talents had not received the recognition they merited, or just a puckish, impish desire to do mischief. He was a crook. It is true that only two cases of dishonesty had been brought home to him, but if he'd been caught twice, it might be surmised that he had often been dishonest without being caught. What did Mrs. Kapor think of this? They were so united that she must be aware of it. Did it make her ashamed? For her own uprightness, surely none could doubt. Or did she accept it as an inevitable kink in the man she loved? Did she do all she could to prevent it, or did she close her eyes to something she could not help? How much easier life would be if people were all black or all white, and how much simpler it would be to act in regard to them. Was Kapor a good man who loved evil, or a bad man who loved good? And how could such unreconcilable elements exist side by side and in harmony within the same heart? For one thing was clear. Kapor was disturbed by no gnawing of conscience. He did his mean and despicable work with gusto. He was a traitor who enjoyed his treachery. Though Ashenden had been studying human nature more or less consciously all his life, it seemed to him that he knew as little about it now in middle age as he had done when he was a child. Of course, R would have said to him, "Why the devil do you waste your time with such nonsense? The man's a dangerous spy, and your business is to lay him by the heels." That was true enough. Ashenden had decided that it would be useless to attempt to make any arrangement with Kapor. Though doubtless he would have no feeling about betraying his employers, he could certainly not be trusted. His wife's influence was too strong. Besides, notwithstanding what he had from time to time told Ashenden, he was in his heart convinced that the Central Powers must win the war, and he meant to be on the winning side. Well, then Kapor must be laid by the heels, but how he was to effect that, Ashenden had no notion. Suddenly, he heard a voice. "There you are! We've been wondering where you'd hidden yourself." He looked round and saw the Kapor strolling toward him. They were walking hand in hand. So this is what has kept you so quiet, said Kapor as his eyes fell on the view. What a spot! Mrs. Kapor clasped her hands. Ach Gott, wie schön, she cried. Wie schön! When I look at that blue lake and those snowy mountains, I feel inclined, like Goethe's Faust, to cry to the passing moment, Terry. That is better than being in England with the excursions and alarums of war, isn't it? Said Kapor. Much, said Ashton. By the way, did you have any difficulty in getting out? No, not the smallest. I'm told they make rather a nuisance of themselves at the frontier nowadays. I came through without the smallest difficulty. I don't fancy they bother much about the English. I thought the examination of passports was quite perfunctory. A fleeting glance passed between Kapor and his wife. Ashenden wondered what it meant. It would be strange if Kapor's thoughts were occupied with the chances of a journey to England at the very moment when he was himself reflecting on its possibility. In a little while, Mrs. Kapor suggested that they had better be starting back, and they wandered together in the shade of trees down the mountain paths. Ashenden was watchful. He could do nothing, and his inactivity irked him, but wait with his eyes open to seize the opportunity that might present itself. A couple of days later, an incident occurred that made him certain something was in the wind. In the course of his morning lesson, Mrs. Kapor remarked, "My husband has gone to Geneva today. He had some business to do there." "Oh," said Ashton, "will he be gone long?" "No, only 2 days." It is not everyone who can tell a lie, and Ashton had the feeling, he hardly knew why, that Mrs. Kapor was telling one then. Her manner perhaps was not quite as indifferent as you would have expected when she was mentioning a fact that could be of no interest to Ashton. It flashed across his mind that Kapor had been summoned to Bern to see the redoubtable head of the German Secret Service. When he had the chance, he said casually to the waitress, "A little less work for you to do, Fräulein. I hear that Herr Kapor has gone to Bern." "Yes, but he'll be back tomorrow." That proved nothing, but it was something to go upon. Ashton knew in Lucerne a Swiss who was willing on emergency to do odd jobs, and looking him up, asked him to take a letter to Bern. It might be possible to pick up Kapor and trace his movements. Next day, Kapor appeared once more with his wife at the dinner table, but merely nodded to Ashenden, and afterwards both went straight upstairs. They looked troubled. Kapor, as a rule so animated, walked with bowed shoulders and looked neither to the right nor to the left. Next morning, Ashenden received a reply to his letter. Kapor had seen Major von P. It was possible to guess what the major had said to him. Ashenden well knew how rough he could be. He was a hard man, and brutal, clever, and unscrupulous, and he was not accustomed to mince his words. They were tired of paying Kapor a salary to sit still in Lucerne and do nothing. The time was come for him to go to England. Guesswork? Of course it was guesswork, but in that trade it mostly was. You had to deduce the animal from its jawbone. Ashenden knew from Gustav that the Germans wanted to send someone to England. He drew a long breath. If Kapor went, he would have to get busy. When Mrs. Kapor came in to give him his lesson, she was dull and listless. She looked tired, and her mouth was set obstinately. It occurred to Ashenden that the Kapors had spent most of the night talking. He wished he knew what they had said. Did she urge him to go, or did she try to dissuade him? Ashenden watched them again at luncheon. Something was the matter, for they hardly spoke to one another, and as a rule they found plenty to talk about. They left the room early, but when Ashenden went out, he saw Kapor sitting in the hall by himself. "Hello," he cried jovially, but surely the effort was patent. "How are you getting on? I've been to Geneva." "So I heard," said Ashenden. "Come and have your coffee with me. My poor wife's got a headache. I told her she'd better go and lie down." In his shifty green eyes was an expression that Ashenden could not read. "The fact is, she's rather worried, poor dear. I'm thinking of going to England." Ashenden's heart gave a sudden leap against his ribs, but his face remained impassive. "Oh, are you going for long? We shall miss you." To tell you the truth, I'm fed up with doing nothing. The war looks as though it were going on for years, and I can't sit here indefinitely. Besides, I can't afford it. I've got to earn my living. I may have a German wife, but I'm an Englishman, hang it all, and I want to do my bit. I could never face my friends again if I just stayed here in ease and comfort till the end of the war and never attempted to do a thing to help my country. My wife takes her German point of view, and I don't mind telling you that she's a bit upset. You know what women are. Now Ashenden knew what it was that he saw in Caper's eyes. Fear. It gave him a nasty turn. Caper didn't want to go to England. He wanted to stay safely in Switzerland. Ashenden knew now what the major had said to him when he went to see him in Bern. He had got to go or lose his salary. What was it that his wife had said when he told her what had happened? He had wanted her to press him to stay, but it was plain she hadn't done that. Perhaps he had not dared tell her how frightened he was. To her, he'd always been gay, bold, adventurous, and devil may care. And now, the prisoner of his own lies, he had not found it in him to confess himself the mean and sneaking coward he was. "Are you going to take your wife with you?" asked Ashenden. "No, she'll stay here." It had been arranged very neatly. Mrs. Caper would receive his letters and forward the information they contained to Bern. "I've been out of England so long that I don't quite know how to set about getting war work. What would you do in my place?" "I don't know. What sort of work are you thinking of?" "Well, you know, I imagine I could do the same thing as you did. I wonder if there's anyone in the censorship department that you could give me a letter of introduction to." It was only by a miracle that Ashenden saved himself from showing by a smothered cry or by a broken gesture how startled he was. But not by Caper's request, by what had just dawned upon him. What an idiot he'd been! He'd been disturbed by the thought that he was wasting his time in Lucerne. He was doing nothing. And though, in fact, as it turned out, Caper was going to England, it was due to no cleverness of his. He could take to himself no credit for the result, and now he saw that he'd been put in Lucerne, told how to describe himself, and given the proper information so that what actually had occurred should occur. It would be a wonderful thing for the German Secret Service to get an agent into the censorship department. And by a happy accident, there was Grantley Caper, the very man for the job, on friendly terms with someone who had worked there. What a bit of luck! Major von P. was a man of culture, and rubbing his hands, he must surely have murmured, "Stultum facit fortuna, quem vult perdere." It was a trap of that devilish R, and the grim major at Bern had fallen into it. Ashenden had done his work just by sitting still and doing nothing. He almost laughed as he thought what a fool R had made of him. "I was on very good terms with the chief of my department. I could give you a note to him if you liked." "That would be just the thing. But of course I must give the facts. I must say I've met you here and only known you a fortnight." "Of course. But you say what else you can for me, won't you?" "Oh, certainly. I don't know yet if I can get a visa. I'm told they're rather fussy." "I don't see why. I shall be very sick if they refuse me one when I want to go back." "I'll go and see how my wife is getting on," said Caper suddenly, getting up. "When will you let me have that letter?" "Whenever you like. Are you going at once?" "As soon as possible." Caper left him. Ashenden waited in the hall for a quarter of an hour, so that there should appear in him no sign of hurry. Then he went upstairs and prepared various communications. In one, he informed R. that Caper was going to England. In another, he made arrangements through Bern that, whenever Caper applied for a visa, it should be granted to him without question, and these he dispatched forthwith. When he went down to dinner, he handed Caper a cordial letter of introduction. Next day but one, Caper left Lucerne. Ashenden waited. He continued to have his hour's lesson with Mrs. Caper, and under her conscientious tuition began now to speak German with ease. They talked of Goethe and Winckelmann, of art and life and travel. Fritzi sat quietly by her chair. "He misses his master," she said, pulling his ears. "He only really cares for him. He suffers me only as belonging to him." After his lesson, Ashenden went every morning to Cook's to ask for his letters. It was here that all communications were addressed to him. He could not move till he received instructions, but R could be trusted not to leave him idle long. And meanwhile, there was nothing for him to do but have patience. Presently, he received a letter from the consul in Geneva to say that Kapor had there applied for his visa and had set out for France. Having read this, Ashenden went on for a little stroll by the lake, and on his way back happened to see Mrs. Kapor coming out of Cook's office. He guessed that she was having her letters addressed there, too. He went up to her. "Have you had news of Herr Kapor?" he asked her. "No," she said. "I suppose I could hardly expect to, yet." He walked along by her side. She was disappointed, but not yet anxious. She knew how irregular at that time was the post. But next day, during the lesson, he could not but see that she was impatient to have done with it. The post was delivered at noon, and at 2:05 she looked at her watch and him. Though Ashenden knew very well that no letter would ever come for her, he had not the heart to keep her on tenterhooks. "Don't you think that's enough for the day? I'm sure you want to go down to Cook's," he said. "Thank you. That's very amiable of you." When a little later he went there himself, he found her standing in the middle of the office. Her face was distraught. She addressed him wildly. "My husband promised to write from Paris. I'm sure there's a letter for me, but these stupid people say there's nothing. They're so careless. It's a scandal." Ashenden did not know what to say. While the clerk was looking through the bundle to see if there was anything for him, she came up to the desk again. "When does the next post come in from France?" she asked. "Sometimes there are letters about 5. I'll come then." She turned and walked rapidly away. Fritzi followed her with his tail between his legs. There was no doubt about it. Already the fear had seized her that something was wrong. Next morning she looked dreadful. She could not have closed her eyes all night. And in the middle of the lesson, she started up from her chair. "You must excuse me, Herr Somerville. I cannot give you a lesson today. I am not feeling well." Before Ashenden could say anything, she'd flung nervously from the room, and in the evening he got a note from her to say that she regretted that she must discontinue giving him conversation lessons. She gave no reason. Then Ashenden saw no more of her. She ceased coming in to meals. Except to go morning and afternoon to Cook's, she spent apparently the whole day in her room. Ashenden thought of her sitting there, hour after hour, with that hideous fear gnawing at her heart. Who could help feeling sorry for her? The time hung heavy on his hands, too. He read a good deal and wrote a little. He hired a canoe and went for long, leisurely paddles on the lake. And at last, one morning, the clerk at Cook's handed him a letter. It was from R. It had all the appearance of a business communication. But between the lines, he read a good deal. "Dear Sir," it began, "the goods, with accompanying letter, dispatched by you from Lucerne have been duly delivered. We are obliged to you for executing our instructions with such promptness." It went on in this strain. R was exultant. Ashenden guessed that Kapor had been arrested and by now had paid the penalty of his crime. He shuddered. He remembered a dreadful scene. Dawn. A cold, gray dawn, with a drizzling rain falling. A man, blindfolded, standing against a wall. An officer, very pale, giving an order. A volley. And then a young soldier, one of the firing party, turning round and holding on to his gun for support, vomiting. The officer turned paler still. And he, Ashenden, feeling dreadfully faint. How terrified Kapor must have been. It was awful when the tears ran down their faces. Ashenden shook himself. He went to the ticket office and, obedient to his orders, bought himself a ticket for Geneva. As he was waiting for his change, Mrs. Kapor came in. He was shocked at the sight of her. She was blowsy and disheveled, and there were heavy rings round her eyes. She was deathly pale. She staggered up to the desk and asked for a letter. The clerk shook his head. "I'm sorry, madam, there's nothing yet." "But look, look, are you sure? Please look again." The misery in her voice was heartrending. The clerk, with a shrug of the shoulders, took out the letters from a pigeonhole and sorted them once more. "No, there's nothing, madam." She gave a hoarse cry of despair, and her face was distorted with anguish. "Oh, God! Oh, God!" she moaned. She turned away, the tears streaming from her weary eyes, and for a moment she stood there like a blind man groping, not knowing which way to go. Then a fearful thing happened. Fritzy, the bull terrier, sat down on his haunches and threw back his head and gave a long, long, melancholy howl. Mrs. Kapor looked at him with terror. Her eyes seemed really to start from her head. The doubt, the gnawing doubt that had tortured her during those dreadful days of suspense, was a doubt no longer. She knew. She staggered blindly into the street.